Back during the Revolutionary War, there was a bit of a standoff that happened for a little more than a year over the city of Boston. The British troops had sort of made that their initial base of operations and had dug in at Boston, and the colonial army had set up shop just sort of outside of Boston, and for over a year, both sides basically just stared across at each other and didn't really do anything. The British were just kind of waiting to get orders from England and hopefully more troops and more supplies, and most historians think they really undersold the American army and what George Washington was thinking. In fact, the British troops in Boston, they try to make life as civilized as possible. So the officers often would go into the Boston Theater House, and they would have plays and little musical productions and just sort of hang out. And in fact, one time, the colonists began to launch an assault outside of Boston, and somebody ran in and told them that, you know, the Americans were moving, and they all laughed, and they thought it was part of the show. And like, wow, such realistic cannon and musket fire sounds. Their budget is incredible. And it turned out, no, the American colonial army was actually moving, and they just thought, oh, this is, and then finally they realized, no, this is a real battle. We have to, like, go. So that's what, you know, the British soldiers were doing. Meanwhile, on the American side, George Washington was trying to hold a ragtag army together. He had no money, and he kept asking, you know, Congress for money to pay the troops, but there was no money to really pay the troops. And so when their terms of service expired, a lot of them, they just went home. And Washington tried to give speeches and get his generals to talk to his men about, you know, we're fighting for the cause of freedom and liberty and we're fighting against tyranny. And that motivated, like, a few people to stick around. But most everybody, when it was time to go home, they just went home. And they even took their muskets and some stuff with them. And Washington at one point told Congress, now we don't have enough guns because our men took the guns that they don't own home with them. So what are we supposed to do? And he's, you know, and what ended up happening on both sides, both the American and the British side, is both armies grew complacent. They got bored. They're just kind of sitting around waiting for something to happen, and nothing was happening. They became very frustrated with the lack of action. The causes began to sort of seem less and less important because we're just all sitting around. And as is often in war, many of them began to grow sick as various diseases and the cold weather ran through the barracks. And they just started to complain more and more because there was nothing to do. What's the point of all of this? Now, Washington, in sort of a Hail Mary effort, sent one of his generals named John Knox up north to a fort to try to capture more weapons and supplies because they didn't have enough. They didn't even have enough gunpowder to fight the British if it came to that. And John Knox was actually successful, or excuse me, Henry Knox, he was successful. And so by the end of January of 1776, over for nearly a year of them just sitting around, here comes Henry Knox with cannons and muskets and some gunpowder and supplies. And Washington finally decided now they had what they needed and they had to do something. So they were going to move on what is called Dorchester Heights, which was a high ground overlooking the city of Boston and, more importantly, the port. And the British, for a while, had been talking about taking Dorchester Heights. Like, everybody thought, aren't you guys going to take that? Because, like, that's kind of like the main weakness. Ah, it's fine. Even if the Americans do take it, we can take it back. They're not a real army. And they waited, and they had their plays, and they sat around. And then all of a sudden, Washington took over Dorchester Heights and put a bunch of cannons there. And the British immediately had to retreat into the harbor and sail away up towards Canada to get away from all of it. And it was that shift in the war that helped spark some confidence in the soldiers, that helped kind of reignite this cause for the American Revolution. Because up until that time, many of the men, they grew complacent. They got bored. They didn't really try very hard. And so we're starting this new series for the next few weeks called We Prevail. We're going to talk about the victory of the church. It's an inevitable victory that Jesus told us is coming, and it's going to happen. But this is a series to challenge all of us to move from complacency to courage. It's a series to challenge us to up our commitments and to stop sitting and to start sacrificing. So in many ways, we too, like those armies, need to recognize there's a mission, there's an opportunity, and we just can't sit around and just wait and wait and wait. So we're going to today be in Matthew chapter 16, if you want to turn there, Matthew chapter 16, which is the first book of your New Testament. where Matthew writes about the life of Jesus. Matthew was one of his followers. And in Matthew 16, before we get to the story we're going to read, Jesus and his disciples, they're on the Lake of Galilee. And after that, they move, in verse 13, to the area of Caesarea Philippi, which is about a 25-mile walk north from the Sea of Galilee. And it's also about a 1,700-foot climb in elevation. So they take a little walk to go out of their way to Caesarea Philippi, which this city is a pagan city. It's not a Jewish city. No Jew would go there. In fact, it's out of their way. And in your Bible, you'll probably read sometimes about a city called Caesarea. Well, there's two. This is the second one. The one that the Bible usually talks about is more on the coast. Caesarea Philippi is different. And so this is kind of a weird place to go. It's got many temples dedicated to idol worship and worshiping the emperor, and especially a pagan god known as Pan, who's sort of a half-man, half-goat sort of person. So I just want to show you a picture from Caesarea Philippi. If you wanted, you could go tour there today, go on a little tour. So this is in Caesarea Philippi. And so kind of on the left of your, kind of center left of the picture, you'll see there's a small group of people standing there. And there's like this little hole cut out of the rock right there. And that's the ruins of a temple to the god Pan. And so they would have a statue of him kind of near that cutout. And you can almost see, there's just along the wall there, kind of further off to the right, there's these little cutouts in the rock where they would have put other statues of idols, false gods, and goddesses for worship. And right next to that small hole is obviously this large gaping hole. That was a cave, and it's fairly dry now, but that cave used to have a spring that was rushing out of it. And they would go there to worship the god Pan, who's a god of fertility and a god of nature. And so they would go to that cave and do some really dark, difficult practices of worship. This was a dark place. Worship here would include prostitution, bestiality, and infant sacrifices. People would take their newborns to that cave, which at that time had this deep pool of water in it. At that time, no one knew how deep it was. They didn't have the right instruments to measure it. Some archaeologists think it was maybe 800 feet deep. We're not really sure. But they would take their newborn babies while they were alive, and they would just throw them in the river to try to satisfy Pan. And of course, those babies would drown in that deep water. That's what they would do. And this is where Jesus takes his disciples. Why on earth would you take your disciples here? This place is terrible, awful, horrible. It had all these temples to various gods. Let me show you another picture that's just sort of a recreation of what we think it would have looked like in Jesus' day. So kind of on the far left, there's a temple there, and the cave is actually behind that temple. So you would go into that temple, you'd go back to that cave entrance where the water is, and you would do your sacrifices. And then there's a little cutout with Pan, and then there were additional temples that you can kind of see. So there are all these different temples to a multitude of gods, multiple acts of worship would be going on here. And it's not hard to imagine that when Jesus takes them to Caesarea Philippi, this might have been the very spot he took them. And he walked them to this place, this giant rock, with all these temples, all this idol worship, all these horrible things going on, to make a really important revelation. And this spot is significant, because the disciples are seeing a dark reality, and yet Jesus has some hope he's going to tell them. So he says in chapter 16, starting with verse 13, when Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" I love how Jesus does that. He's like, okay, that's what other people think. What do you think? I'm not so concerned about what the crowds are saying. I want to know what you think. Because when it comes to what you think about Jesus, this is not a response that you should just copy and paste or ask ChatGPT to write you an essay on. Like, you need to answer the question for yourself. Like, who is Jesus to you? And so we ask that of his disciples. Who do you think I am? So I don't know, did they just kind of stare awkwardly at the floor for a little awkward silence? I'm not really sure. But finally, Peter says, Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. And I wonder if they were standing in front of those temples, I wonder if Peter has a little jab, because there's all these idols, these statues that are dead. People are praying to stone. And he's saying, you're living. Like, you're here. You're not like those statues. You're real. You're here. And Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. Then he ordered his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Messiah. So he takes them to this dark place, and Peter gives the correct answer. He says, you're the Messiah. You're the Son of the living God. And so it's not hard to imagine that if Jesus took his disciples to this place, this rock, and he says, there's going to be something else that will never be defeated. There's another kind of rock that he talks about. It's easy to imagine them watching people go in and out of these temples. I don't know, was it like Disney World where you just got lines and lines out the door? Were there just a few people trickling in? We're not sure, but how many people walked in there with an infant and walked out without one? How many people went into one of those temples looking for hope, looking for power, looking for answers, and they're walking right past the only one who can really do that? And in the midst of this darkness, Jesus has something so important to tell them. And it's just interesting, the contrast here, because the God Pan is a God of shepherding, and yet here is the Good Shepherd, Jesus, in their midst. Peter says, you're the Son of the living God. You're not a dead God like these statues that people are calling out to. And he says, quite literally, this is the gates of Hades. That cave, they called that the gates of Hades, because they believed that river that they couldn't measure how deep it was. They thought that just ran back behind that rock somewhere, and that river took you to the river Styx, which is their myth of the underworld. Like, that's how you got into the underworld. And quite literally, there's the gates of Hades, and Jesus says, the gates of Hades, right there, they will not overcome my church. That's what he tells his disciples. And it's important for us to remember what gates are. Gates are defensive structures. When you are on defense, you put up gates, not when you are on offense. Gates are defensive structures. So just think about when you play defense in sports. When you're on defense, your job is to react and respond. You're trying to see what the offense is going to do and match them or throw a wrench in their plan. That's what you've got to do. You've got to anticipate what the other team will do. That's your job when you're on defense. But when you play offense, you are attacking. You execute your plan when you're on offense. That's your job. That's your task. And I think, unfortunately for a lot of us, we kind of imagine like the church is in this boxing fight and we've just got our arms up and we're back in the corner and Satan's just walloping us, left hook, right, just punch, punch, punch. And we just got our arms up and we're just taking it. And we just know if we just take it enough, eventually Jesus is going to call the fight. Like we just got to stand here and take our hits. But that's actually not at all what Jesus tells us. That's not the word picture that he gives to us. Because what Jesus is saying to us is that the church is actually on offense and Jesus won't let anything stop it. We're the ones on offense. Because there are gates that Hades has to put up. We don't have to worry about gates. And this is a completely different mindset when you change from being on defense to being on offense. It changes the way you think and the way you see things. See, when you're on defense, you focus on trying to stop something instead of trying to start something. So a church on the defense will think, how do we stop things that are going on instead of how can we start something? When a church plays defense, the focus is on preventing things from happening. But when the church plays offense, we focus on advancing. I mean, how many churches do you know that focus on stopping something in the culture rather than starting something that will change the culture? It makes a huge difference. In the early days of the church, it was a common practice for people to take their unwanted children and put them out on the kind of the edges of town near the woods and let them die of either exposure or being eaten by a wild animal. And of course, the early church absolutely did not like this. But they knew that, you know, how do you change that whole cultural system? So instead of stopping something, the church started something. They would, at night, Christians would go out through the streets, they would go around the perimeter of town, and they would kind of check the edge of the woods for kids and babies that had been left out, and they would take them and adopt them. They started practicing, instead of abandoning babies, they started adopting them and raising them as their own instead. And when the church is playing defense, the focus is, well, who's coming at us? Who's our enemy? Who do we have to, like, protect ourselves from? And so you know that a church is playing defense whenever the general tone is complaints, or we kind of have a victim mentality, or we're talking about, man, how we're just being oppressed and how everything's against us and everybody's out to get us. And there's kind of this tone of despair and pessimism when a church plays defense instead of offense. And a church on defense focuses on the opposition and the obstacles, while a church on offense focuses on the opportunities. So the question is, well, what do you see? Do you see obstacles or do you see opportunities? What's got your attention most of the time? And, you know, just to be honest with you, I have heard quite a bit of despair and pessimism the last couple of years. A lot of, what are we going to do? I don't know, man. Look at the world. What are we supposed to do? I've heard a lot of that. And I haven't heard quite as much talk about the opportunities that we have, because there actually are a lot of opportunities. Even though our post-COVID world has its fair share of obstacles, there's also a ton of opportunities. Because more and more people are having this hunger for God. They want to know what truth is. They want to dig down and get the real answers. They don't want simple answers. They like, just tell it to me straight. Let's talk about this. Let's ask tough questions. Let's get to the bottom of it. Younger people are desiring to know about what faith looks like and how does it really impact my entire life. And there's a desire for community. There's so many opportunities out there. But for us, those opportunities are going to require courage from us to trust God, to do things that are a little bit outside of our comfort zone, to do things that maybe we haven't done before, to trust Him with what He's doing in the future. So when you think about what God wants to do in and through you and in and through this church, what do you focus on? Do you focus on the obstacles and the opposition, or do you see the opportunities? Do you see the openings that God has for us, the things that we could do? And, you know, the reason many of us, I think, have found it easy to kind of sit back and just relax and get a little too comfortable and a little too complacent, and instead of sacrificing, we just kind of wait. We kind of maybe took a step back from our commitment to Jesus. And a lot of that is because we've kind of bought into the slide that we're on defense. Our job is we just kind of got to step back. We're supposed to isolate. We just got to kind of hunker down and just kind of ride this storm out. When instead what Jesus says is, no, there are gates. You can go up to the gates and help rescue people from death and darkness. Because Caesarea Philippi, that was a place of complete darkness and false worship. That was a place, that was a location that is the direct opposite of the mission of Jesus. And He takes His disciples there and says, I'm going to build a church, and even a place like this will not overcome it. Nothing will be able to stop the church that Jesus has built and continues to build. And I even have to stop and think about how difficult it might have been for the disciples to believe that this place would one day be a bunch of ruins. Because for us now, it's ruins. Like, you can take a field trip over there, you can take a tour, and some tour guide will walk you around and tell you about what it used to be like, and all that's left is a couple, like, pretty nice carved stones. Like, that's it. The place is gone. Even that grotto, the Gates of Hades, it's different. There was an earthquake in about 1000 AD that altered the course of that stream, so now it doesn't flow out of that face of the rock. It flows a few feet away. So we can go and we can see ruins, but in the days of the disciples, there were temples there. They were active. They were busy. They were popular. I mean, I wonder in their mind how they even thought it would be possible that a place like this might one day not exist anymore. Like, how would it even happen? I mean, they lived under control of the Roman Empire. Temples are everywhere. I mean, yeah, the Jews do their best to stay away from them and not have them in their cities, but the Romans are building temples. And there's no shortage of people who visit those temples and support those temples. And I wonder if maybe the disciples, you know, I just wonder if they were thinking about different strategies that maybe they could do to, like, lower the popularity of those temples or somehow warn people about the dangers of these temples. Or I wonder if they thought, well, Jesus is the Messiah, so surely that means he'll become the king. And when he's the king, he can just make these temples illegal. Problem solved. But Jesus had a very different kind of battle in mind, a spiritual battle, a battle for the hearts and the minds of people. And there are temples today that still exist. They just look different. We don't quite have these same big, ornate buildings, but your temple might be, it might be work, where you put in 70 hours and you sacrifice your health and your relationships and your commitment to God at the altar of success. Or a temple could be an app that just keeps you distracted for hours and hours and hours as you keep swiping, and you miss all these opportunities that God might have for you. Or a temple might be a gym or a field where you invest a lot of blood and tears and sweat to win a competition, but then you don't have a lot of energy to invest in Jesus. We have temples today that they just look a little bit different. And no matter what temple is might still be in your life or what temples you see in the world, these temples are all going to one day be ruins. Like, they're just not going to last. They're not going to answer the deepest questions that you have. They're not going to meet your greatest needs. They can just do that for a little while. And everything that you sacrificed will be for nothing. Meanwhile, Jesus and his church, we're still going to be here. We're still going to be moving forward. So maybe for you today, what you have to ask yourself is there a temple in your life that you need to destroy, that you need to tear down? Is there a way that you need to surround yourself instead with Jesus, or surrender your life to Jesus and give up that temple way of worship and become part of his church? And Jesus, he uses this word church to speak, of course, of God's people all around the world. I mean, at that time for the disciples, it would be hard to imagine that at one point, Christianity would be a worldwide thing. You can go to every corner of the globe and there is an outpost of Jesus' people, worshiping and following him and doing his work where they are. And so our capital C church can never be stopped. But I've got to clarify, there are a few things that Jesus didn't mean would be stopped. He didn't mean that a building won't be stopped. He didn't mean that a particular service time would be stopped. He didn't mean a particular method of ministry would be stopped. He didn't mean a set of traditions would be stopped. He didn't even mean that a specific lower C church would be stopped or that a program would be stopped. Because unfortunately, there are churches that close for several reasons, and maybe you know of some of those. I mean, I preached in a few of those myself, or maybe that the town dries up and there's just nobody left. Sometimes that church lived out its purpose and it's accomplished what it was put in that spot to do, and it no longer is needed. And sometimes churches can sadly forget to stay on mission with Jesus, and so they just kind of shrink down. Or sometimes the people in the neighborhood drastically change, but the church stays the same. Every once in a while I've been in a church sort of like this where you have like the entire neighborhood changes culturally or something, and the church kind of stays just like they've always done, even though their neighbors are very different. And I've preached in a couple of these churches before, especially when I was in college, where whether the town drove up or dried up, or one time I was in a church where pretty good-sized room, and there were 6 people in the church. And there were pictures in the kitchen, in the little kitchen off to the side of the church with, I mean, black and white photos when that church was packed. But there's 6 people. And so I'd come in for Sunday school, and we had a couple folding tables off to the side in front of the stage, and we'd sit down and do a Sunday school lesson, and then we would all get up. They'd go sit on the first 3 or 4 rows, and I would put a little stand just in front. Nobody ever sat on the front row, so it was like the second through the 5th row, and I would preach the sermon, and that's kind of what we did. Why does that happen, though? How do you go from a black and white picture where everything's full? Well, town got a little smaller, church kind of forgot their mission, everybody kind of just left. And so I want to tell you this carefully, but in all seriousness, I know you love Campbellsville Christian Church, and I do too. I want this to be the best church it can possibly be. I really do. I really believe that. However, Campbellsville Christian Church is not the only church in the world. We're not even the only church in town. There are so many churches. And so when we think bigger than just what Jesus has for our church, and we think about what he's going to do for the church, it opens up the opportunities for ways that we can partner with other churches, because we're all on the same team. And it also clarifies how God has uniquely called our church. Maybe there's a type of person, or there's a community, or there's a place where he wants our church to focus in on. Because even we have a part of being on this team. Tim Keller was a pastor in New York City, and he, before he died, he often talked about what he called a gospel ecosystem. And he really thought that every city, every town needed different kinds of churches. It's like you needed a town to have, you know, mega churches and small churches and medium-sized churches and really modern churches and traditional churches and liturgical churches and charismatic churches and missional churches and house churches and Baptists and Methodists and Catholics and Christians and Presbyterians and everything. He had all of it because he thought that would help your whole city out. Because one church may not quite connect with some people, but another church might be great. Or one church might be perfect for just that little neighborhood. One church might be great at reaching those with a lot, and another church might be great at reaching those who don't have much. And we need all those different expressions, and sometimes those expressions remind all the other churches there's more to church than just the particular way that we do things. And so Jesus, his promise here in Matthew 16 reminds us, when one church wins, we all win. We all win. You know, and I got to be honest with you, sometimes, you know, I'll be on social media or something, and even in my heart, I struggle with this. Because I want Campbellsville Christian Church to be the best church it can possibly be. And so I'll scroll through and I'll see another church celebrating like a record attendance, or they had a lot of baptisms, and this is, to my shame, what happens inside of me. I go, they probably saved all those baptisms for one day, just for a good picture. Or those are mostly kids. Like, one day we'll have a bunch of kids grow up and get baptized here too. Like, okay. And inside, sometimes I don't even celebrate. I myself sometimes I'm like, well, I mean, you know, really? But when one church wins, we all win. So yes, commit to this church, love this church, help make this church the best church she can be. But don't get so focused on this church that you forget the global church, that you forget our brothers and sisters all around town and around the world that are all on Jesus' mission too. So every couple of months, we get copies of this magazine called The Christian Standard. And it's sort of the magazine for like our brotherhood, our kind of network of Christian churches. And it just, you know, every couple of months, different theme, different idea. And just so you know, we set these out kind of by the church office. There's like a little wooden magazine rack we put some of these in. And there's some up on the third floor in our resource wall, which if you didn't know, on the third floor we have a resource wall. I think it's great. I put some books out there for you to see and some other biblical resources if you want to go deeper. So there's some like cards with QR codes if you want to watch videos about the Bible and different topics. But anyway, so we set these out. And so this edition is a snapshot of the history of the Christian church. And it has some stories in here about different Christian churches that are seeing their best days right now and even seeing their best days in the future. It's just really encouraging. But if you were to pick one of these up, and if you were to flip to about the middle of the magazine, they have two pages called The Oldest Independent Christian Churches and Churches of Christ. And if you were to look at that first page, and if you were to go down to the bottom, and if you were to go six from the bottom, you would find Campbellsville Christian Church, 1839. There we are. We're on the first page, not the second page, the first page, of the oldest Christian churches in our country. Feels pretty good, right? That's pretty cool. That's neat. But here's what I want you to know. It's great that we're on this list, but how do we stay? How do we continue to be a church into the future, for future generations? How do we build off of the legacy and the tradition we have here? How can we make it so that our best days as a church are in front of us and not behind us? Because I don't want us to be one of those churches where someday a Bible college student comes here to preach because that's all you can get, and there's all these photos in the hallway of back in the day when, man, the room was full and we had all these people and we're doing all this stuff and they just have to stand up here and preach to six people. What would it take for us to trust God that our best days are ahead instead of behind? And every church has the same mission. I know churches come up with mission statements. We have one too, but every church really has the same mission. It's what Jesus said at the end of Matthew: to go make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything Jesus commanded us. Now, every church has put their own spin on this language. That's what every church tries to do. But I also love that in this commissioning statement, Jesus also says, he says, I've been given all power and authority, and I will be with you always. So we're not doing this on our own. We're not doing this under our own power. He's with us. He's going to the gates of Hades with us to rescue people from darkness and from death, people who are lost. He's coming with us on that. So here at Campbellsville Christian Church, the way we kind of phrase that is we exist to connect people to Jesus Christ and into a growing relationship with him. And that's why we have the tree and the whole rooted discipleship framework is because, well, once you get connected to Jesus, how do you have a growing relationship with him? Well, it's rooted. Rooted is the way we try to make it a little easier for you to get your arms around. So how do I have a growing relationship with Jesus? Now, in 1 Corinthians chapter 16, the Apostle Paul, he's a follower of Jesus, and he's writing to a church, and this is what he says. He says, I will stay on at Ephesus until Pentecost, because a great door for effective work has opened to me, and there are many who oppose me. Wait, what? There's a great opportunity here, and there are many who oppose me. That usually doesn't seem to go together, opportunity and opposition. But when you follow Jesus, those two things often go together. And Paul knows that even though there's opposition, this is an opportunity from Jesus to be on his mission. And so this may seem like a contradictory statement, but it's not. Because Paul knows Jesus is going to build his church and nothing can stop it. So he's like, this opposition? Nah, they don't stand a chance. I can put up with that. I can deal with it. And so as believers, for us, what would it take for us to live with this perspective, to have this spirit, to move from a victim mindset and mentality to a victory mentality? What if we as a church decided that instead of staying away from the dark places and the dangerous places, that's where we went? We went right to those places that are maybe uncomfortable for us, that maybe aren't very safe, but those are the people who need Jesus. What would that look like? And that's part of what I love about the Immeasurably More House that we're going to be starting here pretty soon. So you've heard Rodney talk about this a little bit. It's this trailer kind of at the back edge of our property. And the board several months ago decided to purchase this property with the intention of starting something. Because we all know homelessness and learned helplessness is a really big issue in our country, but also especially here in Campbellsville. And we can't stop that wholesale. But what we can do is we can start something that might make a difference. And so once this house is ready to go, we're going to take one person or one family at a time and disciple them in the ways of Jesus. We're going to help them with job skills and life skills and just one step at a time try to help them get some stability in their life. And hopefully that'll lead to them being able to rent a place of their own or buy a place of their own and have a job and hopefully even a career and get to a better place of stability to learn that Jesus has more for them in their identity than what they've accepted. And that's just one way we're trying to help start something that's going to make a difference. I wonder what else we could start. So if you've noticed yourself doing a lot of sitting recently, if you've noticed yourself getting pretty complacent, pretty comfortable, or if you've just kind of found yourself mostly complaining or having a tone of kind of despair and negativity, like, oh my goodness, what are we going to do? I just don't know. That I'm going to challenge you to step up. If that's you, the antidote for comfort and complacency and negativity is do something. Like, don't just sit back and wait. Get involved. Put your faith into action. Get on mission with Jesus because that's going to be the cure. Because nothing is going to stop the church.
And that's a mission worth getting on. So if you're not serving, serve. If you're not part of some kind of small group of any capacity, get into a small group. Have some Christian community in your life. And lastly, commit. And if you haven't committed your life to Jesus yet through baptism, that's your first step. You got to commit to Jesus to be part of this mission. And secondly, if maybe you've been coming here for a while and you haven't decided to officially kind of join us yet, we'd love for you to join us. And in particular, we do that through church membership. And I know, you know, church membership means different things at different churches, to different people. But for us, church membership means that you're making a commitment to us and we're going to make a commitment to you. You're going to commit to be a part of us on mission with Jesus. You're going to commit to being part of our small groups and serving and being part of making the mission of Jesus happen here. And we commit to pastorally look over you and shepherd you and take care of you and be your church family to encourage you and be there for you. So however you need to step up, step up. This is the time. Nothing's going to stop Jesus' mission. So we absolutely don't need to sit around and just wait. Let's go. Jesus, I thank you so much for your promise to us that this church is never going to end. That you are going to use your church in every place, in every season, to impact people. You're going to help to bring the news that you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God, to those who need to hear it. And so, Jesus, we ask you to continue to help rescue people from dark places, help rescue people from the idolatry they're in, or the sin that they're trapped in, or the trauma that they need freed from, or the lies from the enemy they've accepted. Help those who feel like they have no hope in the world find hope through you. And God, please use us. Help us to see those opportunities. Let the Holy Spirit convict us and challenge us and encourage us and open our eyes to see the people and the places that you want us to go. And God, help change our hearts when maybe we're a little too competitive with other churches instead of being collaborators and being on the same team. And God, for those in our community who need you, I pray for them especially. I pray that you would come to them in the way that you know how. So God, help us to have the confidence and the courage of as your sons and your daughters to go with you to rescue people away from the gates of Hades. It's in your name that I pray. Amen.